Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Oran Finnegan joins me this morning. He's a former head of forensics for the International Committee of the Red Cross, and he's had the most interesting career as a humanitarian forensic specialist. His work has taken him all over the world to many war-torn countries, helping families to find loved ones and answers, and he has his own personal experience of what it's like when a loved one disappears and is never heard from again. He's now based back in Ireland, and he's one of the team involved in the excavation of the remains of the 796 children interred in the mass unmarked grave in Tumen, County Galway, near the former mother and baby home, and that is a well-known story to us here. Oran Finnegan, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here today.
You're a County Louth man originally.
I am, very proud. Carlingford born, Dundalk supporting.
Go on the town. And were you out of the country very long then, all told?
I was. I've spent most of my adult life abroad, so the last about 25 years, and finally returned home about 15 months ago.
Oh, very good. Well, welcome home, if we can say.
Thank you very much.
So you're a humanitarian forensic specialist.
Yes.
How do you describe your job to people when they ask?
So it can be a complicated one, and I think some stone faces or from time to time. But I think, simply put, humanitarian forensics is the application of forensic skills and knowledge to humanitarian action. But I think it goes deeper than that. I think that's an overly simplified explanation. I think applying these techniques is more often than not in a very compromised environment. So middle of conflict zones or just after a disaster where you're dealing with very compromised infrastructure. So you're having to think about how you apply these skills in a very challenging environment. And I think that's really the nub or the essence of what humanitarian forensics is and how it has evolved over the last 30 years or so.
So that work has obviously taken you all over the world to various scenes of tragedy, disaster, really difficult, challenging places.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to, I think, travel across the globe, seeing over more than 50 different contexts to provide advice, training, etc. So it's given me a great understanding, but an insight into the rich fabric of cultures and society around the world and how we confront and deal with death, and how we can utilise forensics to aid and support affected communities across the world.
Really important then, and the results do bring comfort and closure to people, doesn't help.
I think closure is probably too strong a word. Yeah. I think this is always a difficult one in terms of how we utilise these terms. I think we help to bring some clarity for people, a sense of certainty around giving a name back to a loved one, knowing the fate or whereabouts of someone. I don't think we ever fully come to terms with these losses, but I think forensics can help give some surety around what has happened, and I think that's greatly important.
So you did your schooling, your training initially in Queen's University in Belfast.
I did a wonderful university, but not the path that I wanted to follow. I think studying anatomy was interesting. However, I remember one day looking round in the laboratory I was in and saying, this cannot be my life.
Right.
And I talked with a mentor and relation of mine, Professor Moira O'Brien, and she advised me to take up and study forensic anthropology, which brought me over to Bradford in England.
Yeah.
And from there, I really sort of found my, I guess, scientific draw. But I felt something was missing. I felt something was missing from that. And I remember towards the end of my year studying, being asked my advisor, would you like to go to Bosnia? They're working on the war graves there. Mm-hmm. Is that something that would interest you? And of course, I jumped at the opportunity.
This is the click in your head. It goes, this is the path I want to go.
I think so. And it was arriving there, I literally handed in my dissertation on a Friday and got on a plane on the Sunday. And next thing I knew, I was in just on the outskirts of Sarajevo, walking up to a temporary morgue with a kaleidoscope of international forensic figures and trying to understand.
This is immediately after the Bosnian War, that is, a mid-90s.
It was about 2 or 3 years after it, and right. It was when the international tribunals were starting to work to collect evidence, to look at bringing to trial those responsible for the atrocities there.
Wow, what a job to start on as a young fella.
I look back in it and I think there's some blanks there for me. I think I didn't really grasp how traumatic it was, and the impact on my mental health. I think in many ways, and I think we often, and I hear from forensic figures how they push this aside. Oh, it's fine. We get through it. But I think that's doesn't really do justice or give credit to the challenges that people in this field face.
And the Srebrenica massacre, I think, was very much part of that initial project, was it?
It was. On the first few weeks I was there, we were working on a number of different sites of mass graves in Bosnia. And for the last few weeks, we were working on sites relating to Srebrenica. And I think this field really has brought to me the worst face of humanity on one hand, but also the best in terms of the commitment of forensic practitioners to find answers, to bring to justice those responsible for these acts. And it can take time.
Yeah.
International justice is a slow wheel mechanism.
Yes.
But many years later, we saw some of those responsible brought to trial and forensic evidence used to bring these people, make them, hold them accountable, which I think was a true testament to where forensics has come over the last number of decades.
And because there were huge denials that any of the atrocities had occurred, particularly the Srebrenica massacre, where people remember 8,000 men and boys are marched into the forest and basically murdered.
Correct.
And just buried there, I presume.
Yeah. And I think someone has always said to me, the bones don't lie. And people can spin stories, but ultimately forensics can bring, not always, but can help to bring to light these atrocities and bring the truth to the table. And I think that's incredibly valuable.
It's really valuable because right now the political climate in Serbia, I don't know if you've been following, is very much, again, denying all of these massacres, but because the material evidence is there, you can't fight the objective reality.
Exactly. And I think we see that across the globe. And I mean, I think forensics can be used both in terms of, you know, from an accountability perspective, but also from that humanitarian perspective. And we have to remember there are thousands of families across all of these context that have lost someone who don't know the fate or whereabouts of their loved one.
Yeah.
And forensics can play a key role in that search process and to help bring families along to ensure we put them at the center of these programs to understand what they need out of the process. And I think forensics can its potential has not been realized yet in terms of how it can help strengthen humanitarian responses in this regard.
One of your key motivating factors is a personal story, isn't it, of a family member who disappears from the family. Can you tell us what happened?
Yes, I remember growing up and my father always talking about his brother, my uncle, Paul, who who left, like many in Ireland, to London, to England, and alas, lost his way and for decades, no one knew his whereabouts. And I remember throughout my youth seeing the impact on my father and the not knowing where he was.
Yeah.
And a strange turn of events. Last year, I was asked about this. And a month later, we received a call to say that my uncle's had died in London just a month previously. And I wanted to go to London, and myself and my twin brother traveled there for the benefit of my relatives and importantly my father. because I felt we needed to, I knew that's what he would have wanted, to go there and to be able to have some certainty that it was him, that I could physically see.
Yeah, he died without knowing himself, your dad.
Correct, okay. Correct.
And so this was just an interview you were doing, and someone says, there's a guy who's missing his uncle, and I think I know
It was an interview about this, and then a month later, it just completely separately, a company that was looking to trace where my uncle was, because he had no living relatives in England.
Yeah.
And it got back, and finally we realised it was him, and we were able to go to London to see where he had lived. And the importance of that, to have, to know his fate, where he was, to be able to lay him to rest. I think the value of that, and how I've seen that etched on the faces of families across the globe, from whether it be from the Philippines to Syria to Yemen to Colombia, it doesn't change. Yes, the world is an incredibly diverse and wonderfully rich place, and we mourn death in very different ways. But at the heart of it, what I've seen across the globe is the need to know, the need to have that certainty. And I think
you absolutely realised this yourself. Who came with you on that trip to London?
That was my identical twin brother, Nevin. Obviously, I mean, we're very close, and I said to him, "Look, I want to go," and he said, "When are we going?" And I think that was important for our family.
Yes, the certainty, as you described
certainty.
At the start.
Certain.
Okay, so you and you often have to deal with families looking for this certainty, don't you? You have to use certain language with them as well.
Yeah, and I think the important thing here, and I think what is very often forgotten, is putting families and communities first. We're very quick to talk. We're not so good at listening. And I think one of the things I have learned over my time is just stop and listen. Listen to what people need, what families need, what communities need. Build programs with them. And that's where my company, Forensic Action International, really has its heart, is around centering programs around communities and families, as they are the ones that need answers, but also to be listened to.
To find out what the question is to begin with.
Yes.
What exactly they're looking for. Going back to then to your career in the Red Cross in particular, Cyprus is a place we don't really talk too much about, that we would know there are, you know, investigations and historic crimes there as well. Can you tell us about your work there?
Sure. So just prior to starting with the International Red Cross, I worked on a project together with the Argentine Forensic Anthropology team under a UN mission. And what the project in Cyprus was looking to do was to help recover and identify those who had died during the intercommunal violence in the 60s and the conflict in the 70s. And I think what was special and really came home for me on the project in Cyprus was that was a project run and still run today by local Cypriot scientists. So they brought together Turkish Cypriots and Greek Cypriots to work and live through their past, to work on the cases from their families. And I think that showed an important role that forensics can play in terms of bringing communities together, you know, and making that, you know, that historical impact. And that's so an incredibly valuable project, and one that's ongoing today, still run and driven by the local Cypriot scientists. And it's building that local capacity that's so integral for these projects to work long term.
Is it often about kind of mass graves and finding the remains, using DNA samples from family members, looking for those answers to bring it to a grave that they can now finally mourn in? Is that the idea?
The DNA is definitely playing a very important role, and growingly so with the very fast advance of genetics. However, the search and identification process is very much multidisciplinary.
Right.
And as I mentioned, humanitarian forensics has to deal often in environments that have limited infrastructure, limited capacity. I remember once traveling to Yemen and arriving at the Forensic Institute, and there was a hole running right through the building where it had been hit by a missile. And Yet the forensic scientists were in there showing me a presentation on a generator of how they had used the limited skill capacities that they had to recover and aid, try and identify the dead from a bomb attack wow. in Sana'a itself. So yes, DNA can play an important role and does. However, it's more holistic.
I see what you mean. I want to talk about the Tomb Store. We're going to have to take a quick break, but right when we come back, we'll talk about what you and your company are going to be doing in the tomb exhumation right after these. Now, there's a message in here. We're with Oran Finnegan, who is a humanitarian forensic specialist. Your listeners are enjoying this interview as much as I am. Maybe they will enjoy a novel as well that touches on a similar topic, the unearthing disappeared people in Cyprus, as you've just discussed. The Island of Missing Trees is called, by Elif Shafak. But I want to come, Oran, to the tomb story. The former mother and baby home people will know, thanks to the local historian Catherine Corliss. She uncovered the names of 796 babies buried in a disused sewage system between 1925 and 1961. What is your involvement in this project, Oran?
So I am running as the forensic program manager. So I'm leading up the forensic side of the project under the direction of our director, Dana McSweeney.
So there has been scans of the ground, have there, done? Is that what we know? Nothing has been, the ground hasn't been touched at all yet?
Correct. At the moment, we're looking to put in place the, ongoingly working to put in place the essential elements to have the project ongoing and to begin with the recovery work in the coming months.
So we don't know exactly when it's going to start, the actual dig.
So our director, Daniel McSweeney, came out recently in the media and gave a time frame from between February to June, depending on surveys and that on the site, and has said, as before, and is any changes from that, changes or any further developments will be articulated through the families and the survivors, first and foremost.
So as you've been describing up to now, you will be chatting to the relatives and the families to find out.
I think that's what our director, Daniel McSweeney, and certainly I firmly believe in, is that putting the families and the survivors at the centre, ensuring that they are fully informed, that they understand what's happening throughout the process, is essential, either in this or any project. What I found in this type of work across the globe is that you must and keep those concerned informed of what is happening. That's essentially important.
Is this emotionally more involving now for you that it's a case back in Ireland, having done so much work all around the world?
You know, I feel really privileged to have the opportunity to come home and to be able to share some of my knowledge and experience on a project of this sort. So yes, I'd followed this for years, and to be able to come back and be part of an incredibly motivated team in this regard is a real privilege for me, and something very special.
This is obviously going to be hugely complex and long, I'd imagine, this whole project.
I think any project of this nature is complex. Every project of this type brings its own challenges. I think what's important is that, and what I've done throughout my career, is sitting down and looking at those challenges and piecing together the best approach to address them. No project is the same. However, there are elements that will always recur time and again. It's about not being blinkered, but keeping an open mind and looking at all possibilities to design the best approach.
Okay, and as we've been hearing from you, it's a very kind of sympathetic process, and it's very delicately done, isn't it? Because we don't know what state this old system is under the ground.
I think, you know, it's the same in any large-scale identification or recovery effort, is that there's only so many knowns. I always talk about it's like a jigsaw puzzle.
Right.
We only have certain pieces of the jigsaw, and until we have all of those pieces, we can't really tell what the picture is. And I've seen that time and again in processes, and it's about keeping that in mind throughout to ensure that we take the right approach.
So DNA matching, I presume, will be used here. Is this going to be on a voluntary basis? The families come forward to supply their own DNA to match heritage? Or because there's no public bank, is it, that you can go to?
Well, all of this is carried through the legislation, through the Burials Act, in terms of how this will be approached. But in any project globally, when we look at DNA identification programs, it's essential to raise awareness of getting relatives to come forward. The more having those relatives come forward is obviously essential. Building trust in a process helps to ensure that people feel comfortable about coming forward. And that's where I mentioned about talking with families, talking with communities. And that, because very often there can be significant mistrust in processes I've seen globally.
Right.
But when you sit down and explain and work through things in a very clear manner, then that helps to dispel some of those misunderstandings and fears.
Yeah, what an extraordinary story, you know, with Catherine Corliss's unearthing of this. It was 2014, it's 11
Correct.
Years ago almost.
Correct.
The whole reason you're back here and running your business in Ireland is a back-to-business thing set up by the state.
I was... I came home, and while I've certainly a bit of experience on the forensic side, I have no experience in running a business. And I arrived home and my mother turned around to me and said, there seems to be this program back for business. So why don't you apply? So I did, and I found it incredibly valuable. Arriving back, having not been in Ireland for over 20 years, having a program that helps to guide returned or returning immigrants.
Great idea.
Irish people with vast experience in different areas to support them about how to set up a business. So that's driven by this Paula Fitzsimons, a real tour de force. This project is supported by the Department of Foreign Affairs because it recognises through its work the great wealth of talent that exists internationally.
And often had to leave.
Exactly.
We can welcome them back.
You know, and the upcoming cycle for Back to Business, the applications, it's worth noting, are closing this Thursday on the 16th.
Oh, right.
So get your name in. I found it a great landing pad. For coming back.
Yeah.
Being able
back to business.com.
Correct.
Is the thing. Well, it's lovely to have you back and to have someone
Thank
of your expertise involved in that sensitive project. And someone says, Oren is absolutely right. The need to know is paramount. The very best of luck with Tuam. And that's from Geraldine, who I think sums it all
thank
up.
Thank you.
Oren Finnegan, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.